If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.
Oh, well, good evening. Well, I say good evening. That's because as I'm recording this, it's 9 o'clock on Thursday night. And I've just got back from going to the theatre with my friend Millie. We went to see Goodnight Oscar at the Barbican. What a wonderful place the Barbican is. I love the theatre at the Barbican. And we watched Sean Hayes and the rest of the cast be extraordinary in this play about, he's a composer. He was many things, actually. And what's so fantastic about the show is that Sean Hayes plays Oscar. Obviously, he's an amazing pianist. And so we get an element of that performance as well. But one of the things that I loved about it, one of the many things I loved about the show was that in the part of it where Sean's playing the piano, he's obviously in character. And it's such a insight into the character in that particular part of the performance. It's very, very good. Quite like them to make it into a film. And also it has very topical tone to it because it's based around this character, Oscar, who has issues with drug addiction and alcohol abuse. And it's set in the 50s, I want to say. And it's the kind of start of that whole kind of late night talk show thing. And there's a whole kind of thematic element to it about censorship, which could not be more fitting with regards to the atrocious news that Jimmy Kimmel's been pulled off air. It's awful. It felt so kind of relevant to today and kind of scary as well, and the fact that those conversations were going on back then and where are we, you know, 70 years later and those conversations are still being had. Anyway, if you get the chance, I don't think the run's got very much long left, but if you do get the chance, if it goes anywhere else in the world, go and watch Sean Hayes be extraordinary in Goodnight Oscar. But let's get into soundtracking, shall we? And thank you so much for listening. This is bonus time again. And when I say bonus, it's like bonus, basically, because we've got not one, but two episodes relating to the music, the wonderful music of Darren Aronofsky's riotous and darkly comic thriller Caught Stealing. We're going to drop the episode featuring composer Rob Simonson shortly, but first it is the turn of the wonderful Joe Talbot from Idols, who collaborated with Rob and the score and also provided original songs for the film. If you listen to the episode with Darren that we put up a couple of weeks ago, you'll have a really kind of better understanding of that whole dynamic, which was so fascinating, so unique and so fitting for the film. And I am so thrilled to share these conversations with you. I had an absolute riot chatting to Joe. So let's get into it and we'll begin with one of those original songs, Doom.
Set fire to the town on me. Set fire to your boys and your king. Set fire to the flag held high. Set fire to your book of lies. Set fire to your gun and your badge. Set fire and reprimand. Set fire to your nice review. Set fire to the tools you use.
How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm in New York for one more day.
Nice.
Is it too noisy? I'm just going back to my hotel now.
I mean, for New York, you'd expect it to be like, you know, sirens and, you know, all that. Well, but it's very, very subdued.
It's a Monday morning in Brooklyn.
There we go. Yeah.
It's easy times.
I was driving around yesterday with your soundtrack on as my soundtrack, driving around in the car at full volume.
How'd it
Oh,
go?
what a treat, mate.
Well, that's the one thing I was trying to focus on with the music side was like momentum. Because obviously it's kind of like an escalation of a story where everything hits the fan, so to speak. And I wanted to have this sense of like propulsion. It was a lot to do with moving and panic, transit. So just working on that with rhythm. I have a fascination with drums. I can't play drums, but I write most of our drums. And it was like, I was fascinated with like funk breaks. And I was going back to listen to a lot of Dilla, how he can like push and pull a rhythm at the same time, putting the kick in a weird place. And I love that idea of controlling someone's heartbeat or mood. Obviously, mood's quite easy, isn't it? It's that, you can do a minor into a major and you feel elation. But I like the idea of a sense of narrative in a rhythm, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That's so interesting because I did an interview with the lovely composer of Birdman a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was amazing. And he's done the score for the studio.
Oh, sick. Yeah.
Yeah, and so that whole idea of percussion and drums being the heartbeat of the musical narrative to it was so interesting to talk to him about. But I love that's so fascinating. How, if you don't play drums, how do you write it? Do you like, I don't know, do you like tap out, sing out, or how do you create and sort of communicate that texture and rhythm that you want to convey?
Edith, I'm going to be honest with you. I beatbox. That's what I do. Yeah, I sing it out. The thing is,
Wicked.
like,
But then
obviously,
it's got a connection then. It's coming from a connection.
But like, the thing that I've been really focusing on recently is like on our new album, I've written this. I think it's probably the best drum beat I've ever, or like, probably the best song I've ever written, and it's super simple. And it's this beat that I've been trying to write for like probably like 8 years. And I'm like, oh no, I can hear it in my head. You like see a cow and then you draw a cow and it doesn't look anything like a cow. I'm like, what is going on? Why is this not the beat? Like, it's such a simple thing. And it was just about literally sitting with John, our drummer, and like, just that's not it. This changed the drum and just moving things slightly, hitting things slightly harder creates a completely different beat. So I had to be really patient with it and learn it. So yeah, I kind of sing it out or tap it out sometimes, but
I
and
love
then
that.
I mean, John's our drummer's like insane. You know, he's so good at interpreting my insanity. So yeah, I sing it out, and I think for me, the rhythm section, drum and bass, is the most important thing. Guitars kind of just get in the way. But I mean, lyrics get in the way to me a lot. I personally, I'm infatuated with music, and like my favorite songs probably have good lyrics, but I couldn't tell you them.
I'm
It's
the
not
same as
words that
you.
grab me, you know?
I'm so bad at remembering lyrics of songs. It's kind of like, but I could probably like sing you the bass line or like tap out the drum thing. And I feel it's like weird. There's almost like an expectation that you should remember lyrics because they're so meaningful. But sometimes it's how you feel rather than what you're being told, I think sometimes is as important.
Yeah, I mean, it's everything to me. I remember, like, when you were just saying then about a bass line, I remember the first time I heard it through the grapevine, and like I remember it as a kid. It's like a sensory memory. I've never really equated what the words mean. Like, even now, I'm like, I heard it through the guy. Like, if I sit there and think about it, I'm like, oh yeah, cool. I know some of the songs are about, but my whole life has been impressed by a song because of its feel. And not the word. Like, I still don't care what Martha Gay's singing about. It changed my life at the same time, and that's a beautiful thing.
Chose hands to make me blue with some other guy.
I had that a couple of weeks ago. I was covering for Joe Wiley on Radio 2, which was just a gift, to be honest. Played Rabbit Run, by the way. It sounded amazing on the radio.
Thank you.
But we played like the entire 8 minutes, 12 seconds of I Am the Resurrection by the Rosies. And for me, it's like that, the best bit of that song is almost where you think it's ended and it comes back in and it's just, it's drums bass. And it's just like, it's like a little kind of conversation that's going on between the two of them. It's just, oh, it's amazing. But when you were chatting to Darren about this, you know, and I got the chance to chat to him last week, and he's just, I mean, he's such a fan and he's so grateful and proud of what you guys have done for him with this film. But with that initial conversation with him about working on the score and what he was looking for and what you wanted to bring to it, was it just kind of, I don't know, was it kind of like, yeah, I'm in? Or was there kind of, how did that start for you? Was it reading a script and what did you respond to?
Yeah, so he said, come around to my place. I've got a script I want to show you. And I was like, ah, oh, cool. Like, why?
Which part do you want me to play?
I was like, something asked me to be like some, I don't know. I didn't really think about the sound. Like, I was just like, cool, you know, like we've hung out before, so it wasn't like that weird. But he gave me the script and I immediately you're like, yeah, 100%. It's an honor. He's my favorite director. I studied film. Bowen and I write visually, you know, so it just makes sense. I think like a lot of musicians, including idols, mistake themselves as being really cinematic. You're so in your own, I was going to say up your own ass, but you're so in your own bubble that like you think things are grander and wider and more cinematic than I think you. I remember I warned a friend. I was like this song's kind of like a grime song, and he listened to it and he's like, what are you talking about? It's not at all. I was like, oh, okay, okay. Because you know, obviously I love grime, but I'm not trying to like wear someone else's hat. Hey Robbie, I'm just doing a podcast
in the middle of the street in Brooklyn.
yeah I get recognized more here than I do in Bristol. Yeah, what was I saying?
You were saying about the grime song. I've written a grime song, and you're like, that's not a grime song.
You have this thing where, like, you know, you get carried away with your own narrative. I always thought, like, Joy as an Actress is the start, you know, Colossus is a very cinematic, grand opening. I don't know. You kind of go on and go, why aren't we getting more syncs? And things? It's like, well, because we're actually quite hard to listen to and not very good for cinema. And it was like a learning curve where when I'm having a conversation with Darren, I was like, absolutely, I want to do your film justice. But you don't have to sit back and go, this isn't doing what's best for the song. This is doing what's best for the film.
Yeah.
So I read the script and I was immediately like, it's important to just take a step back and go, this isn't my rodeo. This is someone else's. And that was the learning curve. It was like writing. I didn't see the film. I just wrote, I think we wrote like 9 songs. Five got through, but yeah, it was all based on the script and watched the film.
Yeah,
so I had to kind of really be mindful of not trying to overwhelm with a sense of my own narrative. It was about writing for a cause, and it worked. I mean, it worked. Yeah. It was just like it was kind of a weird thing going in, not blind, because the script was. It's quite strange watching the film once I read the script. Like, it's very much like. The cadence and the aesthetic.
Yeah.
It kind of fitted what I pictured in my head after reading the script.
Something incredibly sensual in terms of, I think I first went to New York at that time when I was like just starting out at MTV. I was sent out to interview the Beastie Boys and I was terrified.
Oh my God.
And you know, half parts terrified, half parts going, how the hell did I get here kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? And just being so kind of just left with the smells and the taste and the feel of that city. And I feel like I kind of like, it was like a jolt almost watching the film, of being taken back there in the film, and how he really transports you, kind of, you can smell it, all that kind of stuff. So great. And obviously, because it's his, you know, it's his hood, it's his home, he's sort of, he's got it, he's poured that into it. But that must have been really interesting in terms of that idea of being given like a character almost, in a way, to not remove yourself from, you know, as a band kind of going, what are we going to write about? What are we going to, what are our songs going to be about? What's the, almost kind of being given the sort of framework of something to go, this is what the collection of music is going to be framed around. Did that make it not easier, or but was it a nice challenge?
I don't know. Like, you know, when you're given the parameters of like the walls of an album or the walls of something, like a project, it's like you get something to bounce off and be more creative because you literally have like an agenda that makes you more playful or makes you see yourself in a different light. Darren asking us was like, as a fan, but like you suddenly go, oh, what is it that he likes about us that was us in that film in a 90s New York? Because, you know, like the Venn diagram of idols is there is a lot of 90s New York in there, I expect, but I wasn't there. I mean, I got really interested in the idea of doing the aesthetic, like the visuals for the
Yeah,
soundtrack.
he said.
And I was doing all this like found imagery, zine culture type thing. And there's a lot, you know, one of the things as idols is I think a lot of people, we got called a punk band for ages. And I wasn't like, we're not a punk band. I was just like, we wouldn't call ourselves a punk band. I think we're more post-punk. And it's that thing again, you kind of get, you stay in this own, your own bubble and you see yourself as this thing. Like, I was obsessed with like Joy Division and just all the bands that inspired me at the time, Ice Age, or, and you think you're in that world, but then someone listens to you and go, you reminded me of the Clash in 76. And we used to get that all the time. But I literally, I know two Clash songs. You know, as soon as you put something out there into the world, it's theirs, it's not yours. So it's like a cool thing to be able to see ourselves in a different light. We were the idols, not idols, you know, and like we're literally in the film. So it's kind of like this playful thing of like, how far can we take it without it being hammy or cheesy? Because it was important to write really good songs.
Oh, they're so good. And
Thank
that's the
you.
thing as well, of like yesterday, of kind of just listening to them as a collect, like an album in the car, and having it cranked up, having to put the speed limiter on to make sure that I didn't drive so fast, because it encourages that. You really get to see and feel that, the kind of breadth of what you've created, in terms of, yes, you've created songs for this, but you've also got these kind of really great little motifs and melodies that we hear kind of coming back in at certain points for certain characters and stuff. And I imagine that part of it was working with Rob, in terms of, because one of the things that Darren said was that, you know, Rob working as a composer, but wanting you guys to record the stuff that he then wrote, and so that there's that kind of sonic synergy throughout the film and stuff. How was that side of it?
It was fascinating, really. It was quite nerve-wracking being in a room with a guy. He could have been an egomaniac, you don't know. So you get in a room with him, and it's like Darren really wants us to work together. So you're like, well, we'll make it work, but it'd be interesting to see how it goes. And he was just super patient. I think he was probably worried that we were going to be egomaniacs and be like, oh, I'm not playing your music. We want to, you know. We did, you know, there was room for us to write and play around with stuff. And we did loads of experimentation and used the pedal boards. And I think it was a really beautiful thing of seeing someone of Rob's caliber have fun with Lee's pedal board, Bowen's pedal boards, and like be like, oh my God, you know. And I think he was quite envious of how freeing it is to be in a band with a supportive record label like Partisan. And we have a loyal fan base. And Darren's a dream, but I'm sure there are directors out there that are a nightmare to work for. And like, you know, we don't have a client. You know, we don't have to write for anyone but ourselves. Obviously, I think it's utter fabrication to say that people don't think of their audience, but it's true what, you know, Bowie said about as soon as you're playing to them, like, or playing for them instead of, I don't know, it's hard to explain,
Yeah, I
but
know what you
we
mean.
I do not envy Rob's position where, you know, he writes something that's powerful and meaningful and incredible and life-changing, and then the guy's like, nah, it needs to be, this is too much, you know, or whatever. And that would be heartbreaking. I know what it's like to kind of have a song rejected and it's kind of tough. But so it was good. It was really nice to be in a room with a guy, and we both really appreciated each other as our roles, you
Yeah.
know? Like, and I think there was a real sense of relief when it was like, hey, we're just here to work for you, man. You just tell us what to do, and we'll go as far or not as far as you want. And
Yeah.
he was obviously very relaxed about it. He wrote the stuff, and then we built loads of stuff around it, and it was great. It was a steep learning curve, and I'm ready to do it again for sure.
Awesome. Lyrically, what were you using as that kind of jumping off point for? Was it the character or was it the experiences?
I mean, for me, it's the same, really. Actually, it's an interesting, I haven't really thought about this, but I was putting myself in the audience's position to write this. Because
Oh,
I
wow.
always write with the idea, you know, you put your music out there, or your art, or your film, or whatever it is, and it acts as a mirror to yourself. If you write truly or honestly, even if it's complete fantasy, it's a mirror when you create stuff. And hopefully what that happens to the audience, it also feels like a mirror to them, not you. It's not a frame on your ego. It's them seeing themselves in the narrative that you made, the song you wrote, the painting you painted or whatever. So for me, it was like, who am I in this? How messed up am I? It's not about him running from, people aren't interested in just like running from someone trying to kill Hank. It's about someone who's running from themselves.
Yeah.
That's something that I can completely relate to. So I write songs about that. And then hopefully people go, I see myself in Hank. And I see myself in the Gattooth one from that punk band, The Idols.
Not a punk band.
Exactly. Thank you, Edith. So for me, it was just like
Yeah.
empathy. It's like,
Yeah.
as someone who's struggled with addiction and lots of other things I won't go into now, it's easy to kind of relate and create a mirror.
Yeah.
And I hopefully other people see it.
Definitely
Like,
do.
yeah, it was, you know, I didn't want to be too specific in the lyrics, but at the same time, I don't know. I don't know how to do it any other way, really. I just kind of put it out there and see what
Yeah.
happens.
It's really, really powerful. It is really,
Thank
really,
you.
yeah, it's wicked.
I fell in love on the subway, and my baby's always getting down. She said,
experience, you know, in terms of writing purely, you know, a collection of songs as idols, was it a different experience? Or have you taken anything from the experience that, I don't know, has given you a different outlook on how you then approach idols work or not? Or
It's
maybe the
given
reverse of taking how you work with idols into this environment, in this arena, and kind of, because you have done something really unique. You know, there's been plenty of bands who have, or like, you know, Clint Mansell, you know, Darren's worked with loads in terms of musicians who then kind of work in the world of film composing. But this is a different beast, and it's like it works so well.
I think it's given me a real sense of confidence in my own songwriting because a lot of it was written whilst we were on tour.
Bloody hell.
Yeah, so I'd just be given 2 days in a studio in Prague or 2 days in a studio in New Orleans. You know, I'd be writing and then we just have to go in and record. You know, we didn't have a lot of time to mess about. So it gave me a real sense of confidence in like being able to write my own music without Bowen being there,
Yeah.
which was kind of a relief because I love him as a friend and a songwriter. But you, there's a sense of like codependency there. And I know Bowen absolutely doesn't need me. He's like, he's a very astute and confident man. Like he's happy writing on his own. Whereas I've always been a collaborator, and I've got no interest in writing on my own day to day. But I did, and I loved it, and it definitely made me want to. Because the 90s thing for me was like trip hop and hip hop, and the things that I could relate to musically, which was those two things. I grew up on hip hop, so the 90s it would have just been that. So I was like, actually, I really love that idea of injecting hip hop into what I've done, and also idols into hip hop. So I'm interested in playing around with that now. I'm not going to make a hip hop album, but
Why
well,
not?
I say that.
Why not?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know why I said that. I might make a hip hop record. I'm not going to
Wicked.
rap. That's what I mean. I'm not going to rap, Edith. I might beatbox for you now and again, but you're not going to get any lyrics out of me. So I found a new lease of life in terms of
Amazing.
writing on my own. The other thing is like that we can do it. Didn't doubt that we could do it, but now I'm like, oh, we can actually, we got so much more room to grow and so much more work to do. Do it again and put our services out there. So yeah, I think that was it.
Amazing. Well, listen, I'll let you get back to taking a break in between these American dates that you've got going on as well. Yeah, look forward to seeing you back here in the UK at some point live. And huge congratulations on this new collection of music. It really is,
Thank you.
it's so great on its own, but it just works so brilliantly in the context of the film as well, as a character
Thank
within
you.
it. It's lovely chatting to you,
Well,
Joe.
I really appreciate you getting me on, man. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, see you soon. Take care. Safe
All right.
travels.
Lots of love.
Stealing, that's Police and Thieves by Idols, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrack and with the wonderful Joe Talbot.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Huge thanks to Joe for taking the time to talk to me as he walked through the streets of Brooklyn. How good was the signal, by the way? Caught Stealing is still showing in some UK cinemas, so do get along to see it if you haven't already. And the score and songs are available for your listening pleasure on many a streaming platform. If you do want to hear my interview with Darren Aronofsky, you can find it at edithbowman.com, along with every single episode of the podcast. Do follow us on your socials as well. We're at Soundtracking UK, and we also have a YouTube channel called Soundtracking Extra that has got an abundance of material up there. Coming very shortly, we've got Jed Curzo talking about Tornado, Echo Valley, Monkey Man, and just being all round wonderful. Simon Curtis and the cast of Downton Abbey are up there. Jethro Massey, who has a great little independent French independent film out called Paul and Paulette Take a Bath, and loads of other stuff, including the kind of visual versions of the podcast. So please do go and check out our YouTube channel, Soundtrack and Extra. Next up, our second bonus of the day as Rob Simonson joins me to further reflect upon the music in Caught Stealing. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.